Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Today's sponsor of Happy Sad Confused is Loot Crate. For less than $20 a month, Loot Crate gives the geek in you a special treat every month. Loot Crate is a subscription box service with over $40 worth of geek, gamer, and pop culture gear, collectibles, apparel, comics, and more delivered to your mailbox every single month. This month, we're all cowering in fear at the return of the villains. So join Loot Crate as they celebrate everybody's darker side with epic items from Marvel and exclusive DC figure, a unique wearable item that they've never put in a crate before. By the way, this crate is a huge one, and much more. It's good to be bad guys, right? You have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive that month's crate. But when the cutoff happens, guys, just know that's it. It's over. You missed out. So go to lootcrate.com/happy. Enter code HAPPY to save $3 on your new subscription today.
Hey guys, welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. I'm Josh Horowitz. If I sound like I have more gravitas this week, it's only because I have a cold and I'm trying to get sympathy from you. Hi. Joel, do I have your sympathy?
No.
Making his third appearance on the podcast, give it up for Joel.
Hey.
Oh God. Welcome to the show, guys. For those that have been listening to Happy, Sad, Confused for the last year plus, you're awesome.
For the year?
Over a year.
Did you do a big anniversary show?
No, we didn't do an anniversary show. I actually don't know when the official anniversary is. Definitely over a year. Kate Mara was the first guest. And I don't know if we've come a long way as I say that, because I'm still just sitting in an office with crude microphones in front of me and you're here. So,
well, I mean, that's all about perspective.
From Kate Mara to you, Joel.
We're very similar. We're tiny.
Yeah.
We have lovely hair.
Yeah.
That's about
both
it.
Pushed into a train.
By Kevin Spacey. Mine actually happened in real life. It's a funny story. We don't have
long
time for
story.
It.
Next time on the podcast. Joel is joining me in the podcast this week as we are about to introduce my conversation that was just transpired with Mr. Guy Ritchie, which was awesome. Guy Ritchie, I kind of hoped he would be. I've interviewed him a couple times. He's one of those filmmakers that, well, he doesn't have a reputation, but he's got a style. Certainly, I think for good or for bad, and I think it's for good. You know, a Guy Ritchie film when you see one, that flair, for that energy, that he's brought to Sherlock and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, and his new film Man from U.N.C.L.E. Is very identifiable. And of course, it didn't hurt that he was married to Madonna for a few years.
No, I don't see. I mean, that definitely helped his filmmaking. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, meaning his celebrity and that.
Yeah, yes. Right. Put him on from the mainstream. He was an indie darling, and then he really transitioned into.
Exactly. And this conversation was cool because we talk a little bit. He's super, super frank and super open about his trajectory in terms of Lock, Stock was obviously the film that made him a big time filmmaker to be reckoned with. And then Snatch, which, you know, went to the next level. You get Brad Pitt in your movie. Suddenly you're, you know, being noticed by a lot of people. And then we even talk about Swept Away, which was kind of his reckoning, speaking of Madonna, which probably still wounds him to this day a little bit, but actually not. You'll hear in the conversation, he's got a good attitude about the ups and downs he's had. And I think he's experiencing a good up right now with Man from U.N.C.L.E., which, you know, I don't know. I mean, as we tape this is before the movie is open. So I don't know how well it's going to do. I hope it does well. Cause it's legitimately, the marketing has been good, but I think it's actually even a better film than the marketing would indicate. It's based on, 60s TV series, which I feel like is almost weirdly the biggest crutch it has to overcome because Do you know, have you ever heard of Man from U.N.C.L.E., Joel?
No, I don't have any recollection of Man from U.N.C.L.E. And also, I feel like anything you've heard about in the recent pop culture history of things being based on a 60s TV series,
yeah,
haven't really done that well.
No. It's strange. I mean, I don't know what the solution is. I mean, it's a good place to start with the film, because basically the conceit of the film is, you know, that they're spies from different countries, right? Like Napoleon Solo, great name. That's Henry Cavill, American kind of secret agent. And then Armie Hammer's is like a Russian spy, and they have to, you know, through the Cold War, come together and fight for a unified cause. But the title is kind of meaningless, I feel like, to audiences today. But get past that and you'll see a really slick, stylish, and fun spy thriller, much different than Mission Impossible. Like, in the same month, we have two really good spy movies that are much different from each other. And I have to say, really good performances from, and I don't know why I'm necessarily surprised, but Man of Steel, I think, was like, you know, we saw Henry in a certain context. He was like that stoic, you know, Superman. There's only so much dynamism that Superman has. But this character, he did a really good job with. It's really suave and sophisticated and cool. And it's a good movie star role for him. So good for him, and good for Army to find a bounce back after Lone Ranger as well.
Right. And I love his Russian accent in the trailers.
His Russian accent's good. It's, I mean, I'm not one to judge, but it's not, it's honestly not like super distracting.
Is it better than De Niro in Rocky and Bullwinkle?
It's very much inspired by that.
Okay.
Yeah. And the women in it are great. Alicia Vikander, previous podcast guest, is awesome in this, as her great year continues. So this was a blast. I mean, this is exactly the kind of filmmaker I love to have on the show, because he's very frank. And we even geeked out about Mad Max for a little bit. So you know he's a good guy if he loved Mad Max.
Did he like it, I take it?
He loved it.
Okay.
He loved it.
Spoiler, although
he didn't,
sorry.
Although he didn't know, I felt like our one dividing line was, he didn't know the movie Time After Time, which is a great little movie from like the early 80s, late 70s with Malcolm McDowell.
It's Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Joel. I wish you were here when we were recording the podcast.
I was. You just didn't. I was just staring blankly and silently at the back of Guy Ritchie's head.
That's weird, because the office is so small. I don't know how I would have missed you.
I can be very nimble and slight.
That's disgusting. Let's look at some questions via Twitter. From Christina, aka, when you read a Twitter handle, do you read the name that pops up or the @? Do you know what I mean?
Like @ so and so?
So, like, for instance, Christina, who I'm about to read her question, see, it says Christina.
Yes.
And then it says @ Miss Hook 007, which, yeah, by the way, is a great handle. Which would you go, which do I go by?
Do you saying @ Miss Hook, or just say Miss Hook 007?
This is what I'm saying, Joel.
Well, I feel like the convention is.
Or do I call her Christina?
I think you've already addressed her every way possible.
But I guess for the next one, what do I do?
I think Christina @ Miss Hook 007.
That's a mouthful. That's a lot to put on.
Look, you want to give her promotion, okay, and you want to address her by her human normal name,
okay,
not her internet name.
Hi, human Christina @ Miss Hook 007. Your question for me is, hi, do you think Zelina has a true love? Big hug from Paris! Exclamation point. Thank you. Big hug right back from New York City, from me and Joel, collectively.
I'm more like a wave from a,
right,
distance. Nothing personal. It's just, you know, I don't know you.
Okay, a big hug from me, a distant, aloof wave from Joel.
Thank you.
Do I think Zelina has a true love? Absolutely. I'll confess, when I looked this up a minute before we started the podcast, I didn't know what Zelina was. So Zelina, I guess, is a shipping thing going on with Once Upon a Time, which, for those that don't know, my brother, little promotion for my brother, Adam Horowitz, Adam Horowitz LA on Twitter, co-creator of Once Upon a Time. I get a lot of tweets of people about Once Upon a Time. I think, I don't know if they assume that I am my brother, or that I just know everything about the show. Or
I assume that you just call your brother after the show and
just talk for a couple hours. No, I do like the show, but I can't claim to be a true expert. But sure, I think Zelina, don't you? I feel like everybody's got a true love, and Zelina's no different.
I hope so. I'm always rooting for true love. I thought maybe it was Alfred Molina and Zoe Saldana was the ship that they were doing.
Oh, right.
It's not. Unfortunately, it's not. That's only my personal fan fiction.
You should start that up right now. Is it Alfred Molina in the guise of Dr. Octopus? Dr. Octopus. And Neytiri fanfic.
Yeah, and then he does say brilliant but lazy somewhere in there.
What else to talk about? Oh, some cool stuff just to viewable on the website at MTV.com and MTV's YouTube page. Did some fun stuff this week with Kristen Stewart and Jesse Eisenberg. Did a second go around with them for American Ultra, which is a super fun kind of stoner action movie. That was good.
How many years have you been talking to Kristen Stewart?
I mean, virtually since I came here. It's been, I often say, and I kind of want substantiation, I think I've interviewed Kristen Stewart more than any other human being on the planet. And I'm not saying that to brag, but I want, if you need some distinction on the planet Earth, that might be mine.
Congratulations.
What's yours, Joel?
I have nothing. I couldn't even.
Joel, master of improv.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
I just yes-handed that. That's the first thing. Second thing is I just hate myself. So I have nothing
don't
to.
Don't bring us down.
I do. You know what?
I'm just kidding. Do it. I guess that's all the preamble for this week. Thank you, Joel, as always, for joining us. You really killed it again.
Thank you.
Join us next week. Oh, another cool guest. Should I say who? I'm not going to say who it is. It's a really good actor. Oscar-nominated actor. But I don't want to say it because sometimes these things fall through. Trust me. Really good actor coming up next week on Happy, Sad, Confused. But in the meanwhile, let's talk filmmaking with Guy Ritchie. With a British class. They even got him to curse a little bit.
Good job.
Enjoy. Thank you for coming by today, Mr. Guy Ritchie.
Thank you very much for having me.
His voice just went much cooler. We were just having a very casual.
I was up there.
We were dishing on really on summer movies, but now we're on message. No, congratulations again. I got a chance to see your film the other day. I really enjoyed it, man. It's a good ride. Where are you at right now in your head? Because there's a lot going on in your life between wrapping a film, getting married, and putting out a film into the world.
I oscillate between thinking too much about this and caring too much about this to not. And I can tell you I much prefer the latter than the former. The anxiety. I'm pretty cool, if I say this about myself, about making the movie.
Yeah.
And then I don't sleep for a week when it comes to the release of a movie. And I'd like to sort of transcend that anxiety, but I'm not sure if you ever can. You just get your knickers in a twist and don't sleep at night.
Were you like that from the beginning? Was there something of a
I was little, much worse in the beginning.
Oh, really? I think there might be ignorance in the beginning of like, oh, I'm going to ace this. I know what I'm doing.
No, there is. I mean, but if you know, these movies take it, say, a couple of years to make. If you think you're down to a week's anxiety out of 2 years, you know, that's not bad.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you first start, no, there's much more anxiety. So it diminishes. And then, you oscillate between getting your knickers in a twist and not.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're always, but you can feel your body contract.
Yeah.
And then it relaxes. It contracts and relaxes. All about the anxiety of the release. And your intelligence gets the better of you sometimes. You go, you know, in a bigger picture, this all means nothing.
Sure.
And again, you oscillate between big picture and small picture.
In some ways, maybe the timing is good, and that obviously just got married, and you literally just wrapped this another ginormous movie. Maybe you've had less time to obsess.
Yeah, all of that's good, actually. Yeah. Distractions are good, although it's probably not the solution to the problem. It's certainly some version of a Band-Aid.
Right, right. So have you been, we were talking before about, like, there's a spate of really good, actually, spy films this year. Did you view that, including one from a good friend of yours, Matthew Vaughn, which was excellent, Kingsman, but couldn't be more different night and day in terms of vibe. Was that something that you guys talked about? Were you aware of this? Is that something that, again, you overthink, oh God, we're in the middle of all these other movies that are in the same genre, or you're like, oh, fuck it, I've got my own thing, I'm confident what
oh,
I'm
we're
doing.
We're allowed to fuck it on air, right? I see.
I'm setting the vibe for you, so you know. Because I feel like you'll be more comfortable knowing that you can.
Right, now I know where we are. Yeah, it's funny, when you choose these projects, you don't really take into consideration, I mean, as we were discussing before, the spy genre seems to be like it's a crowded market at the moment. But I suspect that all of us, the Vaughn film, Mission Impossible, Us.
Got Bond coming in.
And you
Christmas
got Bond,
yeah.
Whatever that is.
Good luck with that, guys.
And I think we all occupy a very different space.
Yeah.
I mean, we're different in the sense that we're in the 60s and we've got a couple of spies. There you go. Try that.
Just by sheer number, you're winning.
So, it feels like we occupy a different space. So that hasn't really gotten in the way. Vaughn was shooting next door to us, actually, where we were making this. So we'd nip over there for lunch and a bit of a chit-chat. And, I mean, we watched poor old Vaughnie go through the... because we went through prep together. They were in next door offices too.
Right.
And we watched the finances come and go in that movie.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And then, to be fair to Vaughn, he styled it out nicely, didn't he? He just, you know, he rode that very nicely. I mean, like 2 weeks before, they had no money.
Really?
Yeah. So he watched all that anxiety. And then, you know, it turned out to be a massive success for him, which is very good.
So what function do you guys serve in each other's life creatively at this point? Do you give notes on each other's work?
No, nothing at all.
Really?
No, because the thing about, you're either a producer or you're either a director. Once you have two directors, you've really got nothing to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, producers and directors have quite a lot to talk about. Directors to directors, like, hello, mate. Yeah, look nice. Nice.
Like where you put the camera there. Congrats.
Yeah. Yeah. And there it's not a hand and a glove. It's two hands or two gloves.
Yeah. It's interesting. In reading about you, and I've talked to obviously many filmmakers over the years, I feel like you come at it, at filmmaking from a very healthy perspective in that, in terms of the actual production of a film, I feel like a lot of people, and actors included, they almost feel like they have to be tortured. It has to be painful. It has to be something like a process, a gauntlet they have to go through. And you come at it from something where it's like, fair to say you don't come at it from that perspective.
I do not come at it from that perspective. And I'll tell you what, it tickles me watching other people that force themselves into that cauldron. Why would you?
I mean, as if that helps the process in the end.
Well, I mean, you can just hit your head against a wall if you want to, or you don't have to. And we chose the latter. And it does. It's surprising. We have worked with people, actually. We've worked with actors that just didn't feel as though they could give a performance until they'd hit themselves very hard with a hammer 5 minutes before. But some people are just built that way.
So if you've cast an actor already that's in that mindset, how do you?
They don't let you know that. They don't let you know.
And until they get on set and you see they're brooding in a corner and they're...
Oh, yeah. And no, it's happened to us where we were a week in and the actor was putting on a fabulous facade. And then a week in, we started to smell a rat. And we quickly started making phone calls to see if we could replace this individual because we could see that we were, and it was a long haul.
And it was going to affect the rest of the set, I would think.
And it was just going to be a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And there was the crossing the Rubicon moment. And just before we crossed it, we sniffed around and all these other actors that were up for the role, we suddenly were making emergency calls to them to find out if they were still available.
So hypothetically, are you around? Yeah.
It has to be all hypothetical.
Of course.
So all those phone calls were made and then they're all busy. And then...
So you stuck through it.
And then you have no choice. And then you open up their trailer in the morning and there they are with a bleeding hammer in their hands and they're unconscious on the trailer floor.
Wait, is this metaphorical or is this literal?
Not really. And then they drag themselves onto set, what's left of them. And then what they can't, after they've done a proper job with themselves on the hammer, then they turn the hammer on everyone else.
God.
And you just have to put up with that for months. And it's a sickness. It's a proper dysfunctional illness that some people are afflicted by. And you would have thought...
And yet Tom Hardy is Mad Max now. Congratulations. I thought it was just... I toss one out there, see what happens.
I didn't say it was male, by the way.
Oh, okay. Just fishing always.
So there are... It's a funny thing. I think when you decide... to go into this business, there's a motive somewhere, there's a seed, there's a genesis. And depending on what that genesis was, whether it came with levity or it came with weight, dictates about which route you're going to take in this game. And from the beginning, I always thought filmmaking should be fun and a privilege in a way. It's sort of like, I still see it, something like a sort of school project where someone said to you, the most fun that you ever had at school was sort of doing projects, right?
Right.
And someone said, look, go and make, here's a video camera, and here's $25, and you four, you're going to be director, you're going to be producer, and you two are going to be the actors. Now go make something.
Yeah.
You know, and you go, oh, right, I've got 24 hours, you've got to cobble it all together and see what we can get. And it still feels like that to me. filmmaking. It's just you get a bit more than $25 and you get a couple more actors. And it feels like the sort of the grown-up version of a school project.
Yeah.
And I think if you can hold on to that, then it's the entire process is pleasurable. I mean, I cannot tell you how pleasurable I find it. The only time that I don't find pleasurable is the anxiety, like
around
this time
this
now.
Moment right now.
Yeah, but I tell you what, you know what? Like I say, if that's the price,
it's worth it.
It's worth it.
Yeah. I mean,
compared to the poor guy that's hammering themselves, right? And then they hammer their way through the entire process. And there's something self-destructive about that. They're trying to bring on their own demise before the demise is brought on themselves.
Right. I'm going to be in control of the situation to a degree, which is a little fucked up in the head, but whatever gets
you
through the day.
There you go with that naughty word again.
Sorry. Look, I've been at MTV for years where I haven't been able to curse. So once I got a podcast, I'm like, I'm going to fucking curse as much as I can.
Okay. I'll get there in a second when I build up some courage.
I think you can handle it. But it's also interesting you've been able to navigate that, and that still comes through, that kind of that joy that's on set, to these films that are not independent films. These are studio films. These are high-budget films. And that's it seems like you seamlessly made that transition. We're able to retain that spirit that was in Lock, Stock through Sherlock films, through this one. And that's a tough road for a lot of filmmakers.
Well, it's been a journey, and it hasn't all been pretty, my journey. You know, I came out of the slips quite rapidly, and I'd argue really too rapidly, because people knew who you were, and I was a relatively inexperienced filmmaker, and what I'd rather have done is come up slightly slower and exercised more of a creative expression in all sorts of genres, which ironically I'm sort of doing now. And so I would have felt more experienced. And then what happened was I came out quite fast, and then I thought, well, I want to try the stuff.
Getting opportunity, it's hard to say no. Hey, I'll give you some more tools here.
And there's all sorts of other things that happen too. There's strange psychological things that happen to you, because all of a sudden you're making money that you never thought you'd ever make.
Right.
And in a weekend, like when Lock, Stock came out, I made more money in that first weekend than I ever thought I'd make in my entire life. And the weekend before, I mean, I was on $200 a week previous to that. And then that plays with your nut. And it plays with your nut because you think, because we're all conditioned to believe that money is going to take care of all of our issues.
Don't dissuade us of this guy, please.
And then you find you've still got that itch and that you cannot scratch it. By the way, it does take care of a lot of issues, but it doesn't take care of the fundamental issue. So, and then you have all sorts of issues with that. I mean, it's a whole fucking growing process. Oh, there we go.
Yes, welcome.
It's a whole growing process, right? So you're growing at the same time you're exercising your creative, your job, essentially. Yeah. And through that process, you have ups and you have downs, and you make things that are accessible and things that are not accessible. And then in the end, you find what you believe to be, you find where you think the margins of acceptability in terms of an audience lie. And of course you want to somehow straddle that line.
Sure.
You know, you want to keep challenging yourself and making things that are interesting, but simultaneously hold on to an audience. And, you know, it's a business after all. And, you know, you want to make sure that if someone lends you $10, you give them $12 back or whatever it is.
I mean, you know, you mentioned sort of like, you know, you kind of accelerated that career, accelerated maybe more quickly than you could have ever anticipated and maybe in retrospect even wanted. When you look back, I mean, it doesn't seem like looking at the filmography, you know, you can assign things based on critical reception or commercial reception that were maybe a misfire or two. Do you consider any of them, like, do you look back at them with any of them with like regret, or do you feel pride in all of them?
It's a good question, and I'm not sure how to give you an answer because I'm not sure how honest I can be.
You can be super honest.
So, how honest I think I am and how honest I really am are two different honests.
Got it.
Okay. Right? So, I would say, and this is as honest as I can be, I don't regret any of it, but I'm also in a position where I don't have to regret any of it.
Right.
You know? So, if I rattle through how my films went, so Lock, Stock did very well, and then Snatch did very well. And then I did Swept Away, which was arguably, you know, I got properly
You went through the paces.
Oh yeah, I got properly. The thing was, is also I was married to one of the most famous women in the world at the time.
I hadn't heard about that.
Which
really?
Made it also incredibly public because it became such a story in itself.
Yeah.
And then she was in the film, and then I was like, I like the movie.
Yeah.
And then neither of us took a fee on the movie. And we thought, well, you know, we're not going to get...
What can we lose?
We're not going to get judged on this. Exactly. Everyone knows we're not getting paid. And then, of course, it didn't transpire like that. And then you've got to reflect back on the naivety of that.
Yeah. It was your time to be whipped in the press. It was like everybody gets their time, and apparently that was your moment.
Well, then there was Revolver.
Well, at least that was a lower key.
But I tell you what, it wasn't in the UK.
Really?
Oh, no. I got... properly. Oh yeah, by the time I'd finished with those two, my confidence was truly shaken, because they were films I still liked.
Yeah.
Right, and they both embodied things that I thought were interesting and creative, and all of that was thrown to the wind. And you were just judged on the critics.
Yeah.
and whether you're successful or not. So there were those two, and that hurt, in the sense that you had to try and get your confidence back, and you had to try and get a job back.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, it wasn't easy. So, and then...
Is that rock and roller then?
And then it was rock and roller. And then, and it was hard to get that money, you know? And again, I'm not sure if I took a fee or anything on that. And then from there, people went, oh, they got their sort of confidence back. And then since then, I've, you know, been easy since then. But none of it's easy, but it's, to a degree, it's understanding, you know,
yeah.
as I say, this unseen line of where people will follow you. Now, some of that's vitriolic and angry and egotistical, and some of it's realistic.
Sure.
And acceptable. However, you have to live within both of those worlds, right? So somehow you have to reconcile all of our egos. So we have to accept that people will be vitriolic if they're allowed to be, if you give them an opportunity to be. And you can't be naive about that. And as I say, I'm borrowing money to make a film, and I'm interested in making a profit on borrowing money at the same time making creative product that's worth making.
Hey guys, would you classify yourself as a geek, gamer, or pop culture nerd? I assume if you're listening to the show, you're probably all three. Well, don't worry. Loot Crate is the subscription box for you, if that's what describes you. Loot Crate is a subscription box service with over $40 worth of geek, gamer, and pop culture gear, collectibles, apparel, comics, and more delivered to your mailbox every month. So make sure to head to lootcrate.com/happy and enter the code HAPPY to save $3 on any new subscription. Each month is a different theme. All are inspired by classic movie and video game releases, as well as pulling from pop culture franchises. Previous crates have included items from franchises like Star Wars, Marvel, The Walking Dead, Legend of Zelda, and much, much more. This month, we're all cowering in fear at the return of the villains. Whether they're terrifying or tragic, something about bad guys and gals is just plain fun. Probably the snazzy outfits, army of henchmen, and totally relatable treat yourself to some sweet loot attitude, right? Thanks for joining us as we celebrate our darker side with epic items from Marvel, an exclusive DC figure, a unique wearable item they've never put in a crate before. By the way, this is a huge crate this month. Just remember, it's good to be bad. Basically, Loot Crate is like a good friend who knows what you love and surprises you with an awesome present every month. And did I mention that they ship to over 13 different countries too? You guys have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive that month's crate. Just know that when the cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. You missed out. So go to lootcrate.com/happy and enter the code HAPPY to save $3 on your new subscription today.
Maybe there is comfort also to be gleaned from, you know, talking to many filmmakers and actors over the year, that this is, it doesn't maybe help the wound in the moment, but that a lot of films people come back around to. I don't know if maybe the you know, what was assigned to Swept Away was so big and so harsh. Maybe it's going to take another 5 years for people to really truly watch it without any kind of baggage. But I feel like it happens at a certain point where there is a new appreciation. There is a new way to interpret something without the baggage at the time.
Right. And that may be the case. You can probably tell now, and I can say this with as much honesty as I can believe that I can muster, is I don't care. You know, I don't care now because I don't have to care.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and the other thing is I gave up reading
the reviews.
The reviews years ago. And that's not out of kind of spite, yeah. or it's just really practical.
Absolutely.
It's a practical decision.
It must screw with your head. Yeah,
but it, you know, you go up, you go down, you go up, you go down, and there's a worm and there's a hook in the worm, and the worm tastes good, and then you realize there's a hook in it. You know, so if you look at all worms,
wait a second,
as
I was
hooks,
a genius a second ago. What happened? I thought we all agreed on that.
So if you look at all of it like hooks, then you don't get drawn into it, yeah. and you just, you know, I enjoy the films I make. I'm slightly embarrassed to admit that, but partly because I forget that I made them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went to that screening that you went to a couple of nights ago, and that's the first time I've seen it with an audience. You know, up until now, I've only seen it with five people.
Wow.
So, and I forgot that I had anything to do with it. And there's all sorts of things in there which I thought I'd not seen before. I obviously have seen it before, but I think,
do they not let you in the edit room? Have you been separated from the process?
You just forget, you know. Yeah. You know, every now and
well,
then
you're also hearing different reactions that don't happen in an edit room when it's two guys or
that's four certainly guys true. But I'm telling you, it's more than that. You know, I caught Snatch on TV the other day, and I couldn't remember anything about it at all. And by the time it finished, I thought, yeah, oh, that was a great movie. You made that. So it's a relief that I like that aspect of filmmaking. You know, I like the aspect that I'm not self-flagellating. It's not awkward for me to watch these things. You know, I just forget. I just become a popcorn eater, put my feet up and, you know, get stuck in.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Smy Movie, because I know a subject you've been talking a lot about lately, but like, give me a sense of your... where you come at spy movies. Like, who was your Bond growing up? What was your...
Bond was probably my Bond, in the sense that, well, there was the Ypres file. There was Palmer, Harry Palmer, I think it was his name. Mm-hmm. And help me out with his name.
Michael Caine.
Michael Caine. So I adored Michael Caine in those. There was a particular genre. There wasn't just the Ypres file. There was another one.
There was another Harry Palmer movie.
There were three Harry Palmer movies, I seem to remember. Anyway, he was a kind of great character, and you'll be able to tell that actually we're influenced more by Palmer than we are by Bond, to a degree, in the sense that Palmer comes from a sort of a mischievous background,
right?
Rather than just being a civil servant.
Yes.
You know, it's hard.
Napoleon Solo has some ulterior motives in it for himself.
Well,
he's
developed skills. Which are sort of capitalistic skills that he developed as a squirrel trying to get a nut.
Yeah.
As opposed to, he's a guy that went to college and he went and joined His Majesty's secrets, His Majesty's government, and then the Secret Service.
Right.
For me, that's all a bit of a, I'm not sure how interested in that man I am, because he sounds like a civil servant. Bond has made it manifest wonderfully.
Sure.
But it's not such a sexy beginning as a guy that came up the hard way, was a squirrel that developed all the requisite skills that you need to acquire a nut.
Right.
And then he has to work for a government because they have something over it. It's either a 5-year jail sentence or whatever it is. But they can see his skill set is what they require. And I like that guy. I'm more interested in that guy. We're always more interested in guys with character, which usually involves some kind of nefarious activity, then we are interested in good guys. Good guys are bland. And the first Bonds, you know, they had Sean Connery, and Sean Connery just felt like a naughty boy.
Yes.
So they transcended lots of the inherent issues of just being a boring civil servant, because he was cocky and had swagger and was politically incorrect. And somehow all of that, but just oodles of charm.
Yeah.
And I was influenced by that. So a cross between Harry Palmer, a bit of early Bond. It really, what you're interested in is coming up with an alibi for how to illustrate an interesting character. And the spy genre just seems to be just another way of doing that. I'm not really interested in spies. I'm interested in character.
Yep.
And the genre allows me to warm my hands off character.
And in this one, I was talking to you, you know, off mic before, like, you've cast this one exceptionally well, and you've put actors in it that I've enjoyed in other things, but I've enjoyed them more in this than anything else I've seen. Henry, I think, is going to do more for his career in a weird way than Man of Steel, in that it's showing how charming he can be. You know, Superman is a lot of things. He's not necessarily the most fun character to be around and charming man to be around. I'm curious because like every cool actor in Hollywood was, or in the world was like mentioned for these roles at a certain point. Cruise was attached to it, I know briefly. And that's interesting to me just because of who he is and how big a star he is. And I wonder if that would have changed the dynamic of that relationship. I mean, did the film change much when it went from someone like Tom Cruise in Napoleon Solo to someone like Henry? Because right now it feels like a two-hander or even a four-hander, if you want to include the two great leading ladies you have.
Yeah, I think I can... I'm very flexible because, you know, we write all of this material. I'm very flexible about being able to move... My original idea for Napoleon Solo was that he was going to be... Brad Pitt was who I wanted, actually. I asked Pitt to do everything. But so does everyone else. But
You actually have the number, so that helps.
And I wanted him to play the older role, and I wanted the Russian to play the younger role. Mm-hmm. So there was going to be an age disparity as well there. And then Pitt told me to piss off. So and Tom didn't. So then I had Tom. And then that dynamic was I wanted Tom to be older and, you know, the same thing. And I can make that work. And then, needless to say, Mission Impossible interfered with the process, sure. Considering that's come out 2 weeks ago and we're coming out 2 weeks later. So, you know, he was occupying too much of the same space, so that fell apart. And then, you know, I got two guys that were... Both of them were actually reading for the Russian.
Oh, right.
So, and Henry was reading for the Russian, but Henry with blonde hair looks silly. So that he was out of the equation. But once the Tom thing didn't work, then obviously it just made sense to sort of put him into that slot. But that took me all of 30 seconds to be able to shift from having an older guy to having two guys of the same age.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of flexibility in what it is that, how I can make something work. What I'm interested in is tone, right? So, I can make it work in terms of tone. If he's an older guy, if he's a black guy, if he's a Chinese guy, none of that interferes with the process, or where they come from, as long as you can stick to the tone. And that was my only concern, really, because I like the tone of the original series, and I like the way it didn't take itself too seriously, but it still had stakes, and that's really what I wanted to capture. So. You know, you give me all sorts of actors and I could have made it work. I would have made some incarnation of that work.
You previously on the podcast, I had Jude on a few months ago and we were talking about Sherlock, of course, and he was talking about these amazing, it sounds like amazing sessions that you guys have where you kind of get in a room maybe a few times over the last few years in terms of like figuring out what Sherlock, the next Sherlock would be. He was saying that he had an insane idea at one point to involve time travel in a Sherlock sequel. Where did you come down on Jude's idea about time travel?
Ivan, who's sitting next to us, has been through a lot of this with me. Jude actually had very good ideas all the way through the process. And, you know, my experience is most actors are creative, sure. And they have ideas, and by no means am I the custodian of creative ideas. I am the guy that just goes, oh, that's a good one. Oh, that's actually a good one. I just sort of, I cobble them together.
Yeah.
So it sort of turns into some kind of film. But the more people that chip in, actually, the sort of happier I am. And Jude always had good ideas, surprisingly good, and came up with some good lines too. The time travel one may not have been his
top five.
That wasn't the zenith of his ideas.
Look, as someone what was the film, the H.G. Wells one, Time After Time, that worked. That had time travel in it. That involved a little Arthur Conan Doyle and Jack the Ripper action. It's been done.
Yeah, I don't know what the fuck you're talking
really?
About.
You don't remember that one? Time After Time?
Ivan, help me out here, mate.
I'll get you the DVD. It's okay.
Okay. It's
80s movie.
Okay.
Malcolm McDowell.
Okay.
Trust me on this one. Okay. You have just wrapped, I think you have wrapped, right? Knights of the Round Table?
Yeah.
Which sounds like, I mean, I'm curious about this on many respects, you know, given the kinds of, you know, work you've done to see what your take on something like this will be is fascinating. I mean, you were talking about sort of like, yeah, ironically, it's kind of inversely happened in your career where you're now almost like pushing yourself in more unique, strange areas later in your career as opposed to earlier. This feels like kind of a departure in many ways. I mean, would you say it is, or does it feel
I would, but I suspect, and there's nothing more that irritates me when people say this, so forgive me, you know what I'm like, you know, like, well, actually, I don't really know what you're like, because why would you think right. that I think about what you're like, right?
You've spent a lot of hours thinking about my my style, Josh, right?
But my suspicion is, if you've seen a few of my films, you'll have a take on what it is that you think I'm probably going to do with Knights of the Round Table. And I imagine you'll be sort of within 10 or 15% right, accurate in your perception. And I think that's probably what's happened. I mean, I got a lot more money than I've ever had. And that's been unbelievably fun. It's funny, as I've been comparing, you know, I just watched the first four reels of King Arthur, and you see the scale, the muscularity of it dwarfs anything that, you know, I feel sort of rather, we feel like we're playing in a very small sandpit with anything else. And then you come into this world and you really are playing on the beach.
Well, even when this was, I don't know if it was officially announced, but there was talk like this is part of potentially a six film saga. And like, I mean, that's ambitious. And I know obviously your task is to make one that works.
That's right.
On its own.
That's it.
I mean, does magic figure into this? Do you have Merlin? Is that
something? Yeah. I mean, actually, there was a chap, I'll take as much credit as I can wherever I can. but there was a chap called Joby Harold, who's an English guy, a screenwriter. And he came up with one simple pitch. Yeah, I've been working on this for quite some time, the King Arthur story. And I'll take the credit on the fact that the story is essentially mine. But there were two elements which were fundamental, which changed the whole equation and make the idea of this being a franchise work. And that was, you've got some of the most iconic characters in narrative history. So you've got King Arthur, you've got Lancelot, you've got Guinevere, you've got Merlin,
sure.
you've got, who else you got?
Is that your you lot? Got that stone, the stone's right
you
there.
You got the stone, you've got a sword, you got Excalibur. So by the way, there's a lot of guff going on here, right? Now, our problem was we were all trying to put all of this information into one right. film. Well, all you do is you use one of those elements in one film. So you take King Arthur, and we've ended up using the sword as well. Sure. But that's two elements, two heavy elements that everyone's heard of. So the sword, the stone, King Arthur. If you start playing with Guinevere, if you start playing with Lancelot, if you start playing with Merlin, it starts getting very congested, and that becomes a problem because all of those characters warrant a film on their own.
Right.
So that was one sort of masterstroke that this chap came up with. And the other one was the size of the fantasy. And that made it competitive and it made sense. So you had a sort of perfect alibi as to be fantastic. So you can have 300 foot elephants in a film where a sword is being extracted from a stone, and you can deal with one or two very well-known brands or characters without, as I say, becoming too congested. So that was the sort of masterstroke. That was a 30-second pitch. Thin out the narrative, just deal with one iconic character and put in 300-foot elephants. And, and by the way,
where do I sign up?
Boom.
Come on.
And we all put our hands out in a room. And that was a 30-second pitch.
Amazing. I've got a bunch of random things I want to ask you about stuff in your career, because I am a fan and I followed your career closely over the years. I remember, and I loved what Jared did with Moriarty, I will say, in Sherlock. But I do remember there was rumor at one time, Brad was rumored.
There you go again.
I know, always. Do you just always
that name's
going
to keep coming out? He knows this. It was very sweet to turn up to my wedding the other day, just because I think I've just worn him down.
Just to perpetuate them.
Yeah. And he knows he's going to get the call on the next one. And he's going to carry on.
What about Daniel Day-Lewis? Did you ever try to get him? Did you ever get to meet
with Daniel Day-Lewis? We did. I didn't meet. I met him when he was a cobbler.
he was in that mode? Oh, my God.
He was. Yeah, this was previous. I was on the piss somewhere in, where is it?
That's years ago now.
It was. Where was it? It was in Italy, but I'm just trying to think of one of those Italian cities where he was. Well, Florence. I think he was a cobbler in Florence.
The gangs of New York. That was that whole thing.
And it was. And I think we went on the piss back then for a night, which I've done with quite a few actors in the past. And
it's an initiation. You got to go through it.
But by the way, it is a sort of initiation if that's the language you speak. I mean, I cast all my actors on how much I get on with them. So
it goes back to the bloody hammer. I mean, they have
it
to,
does, it know, does. You know. Yeah. And so, you know, a night in the pub usually sorts out the boys from the toys. So, yeah, that is a sort of an organic process. I very rarely talk about the work itself and just talk about, are we going to get on?
Because there's the presumption by this point that you know how to act, that you know what you're doing. And almost as important at this point is, are we going to get on
that's
4 months?
That's it. You know, do they get your tone? Do you get their tone? And are you going to get along? And that's really the lion's share of my concern there. You're right. We're all long enough in the tooth to be able to go, well, I know you can do it. So the question is now, can we do it and enjoy ourselves?
Yeah. So Daniel didn't. That was just so that,
and then, no, and then there, it did. There was dialogue that was open, but I've had this conversation with lots of actors. And it's a painful, long, tedious process because there's lots of people in the middle, and it's much easier now if I ever get my hands on an actor, I get their number directly, so we can just have the conversation directly. Because it wouldn't have worked with Jude, and we've just done another film. We did King Arthur with Jude, and it wouldn't have worked with Jude if the middlemen were allowed to have their way. In the end, I just called up, Jude, make it happen. And it happened. And had I not had his phone number, it just wouldn't have happened. Right, I'm getting distracted. Sorry, where was I?
No, it's all good. So it's Daniel.
And there was a process, and there's toing and froing. And in the end, you just fucking balls to this. And then you end up going with something that will actually,
knows what he's doing. Jared's
or,
solid.
Or Jared's solid, and he's wonderful. And but you end up going with someone that you know that you can get on the phone, that you can meet in a room and, you can get on the piss with.
I'm kind of surprised given, and you're one of these filmmakers that I feel like in this day and age, it's rare to have like an association with a studio that's ongoing. It's like you think of Clint Eastwood back in the day, but you've worked a lot with Warner Brothers. And I'm kind of surprised that I'm sure you've talked to them about comic book movies. I'm sure that you've had those meetings at least to talk about it since they're so active in that space. Is that something that you've come? I mean, because I remember we've even talked back in the day. I feel like that Sergeant Rock was talked about. Was Lobo even in the mix at one point?
Yeah, it was. I'm quite glad I didn't. Well, I got to say, the Sergeant Rock's pretty good. And I rewrote the script on that. And I've got to say, I like it.
Yeah.
And it was pretty good. I don't know what's happened to that. It sort of fell by the wayside and someone's got their hands on it. Yeah, but a lot of these issues are administrative and who has the rights and how much they want and yada, yada, yada. I think that's the problem with Sergeant Rock.
And fitting into their grand plan too, like maybe prioritizing the superheroes over the other stuff.
Maybe as I know is if someone had made it simple for me to make Sergeant Rock, I would have made a very good version of Sergeant Rock.
Yeah.
So we'll put a pin in that. Lobo, I'm glad we didn't go near that.
Why is that?
Well, it's just because I don't think I could have done a good job. Mm-hmm. And at the right time, I was having the chap who was head of the studio then. Jeff and I had a conversation and he went, you don't really want to do this, do you? And I went, no, I don't. And he went, okay, we'll let this one go. So, and I'm glad that happened because I wouldn't have known how to pull that one off. But I was, in the stage where I'm prepared to try new things.
Sure.
But I've got to tell you, I think I would have cocked that one up. Yeah. And then since then, I've been distracted with being busy with other projects. Warner have been great to me. They've been... I have no horror stories about Warners.
Yeah.
They are there to facilitate the filmmaker, in my experience. And there's been nothing other than a helping hand at any time. I've got to tell you, they're adults and they run a pretty pretty grown up show there.
Are you a big consumer of film nowadays? I mean, do you watch a lot?
I watch a lot of film.
So what are some films in the last? You've been pretty busy lately,
but fucker. this is the dreaded question, right? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw it back onto you, and you're going to tell me all of these films. Then I'm going to tell you what I think of them.
Speaking of Warner, Mad Max is
we love Mad Max.
I think is amazing.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, Ivan. Again, who's sitting next to me here, Ivan and I. Ivan is a real film buff, and he's my encyclopedia of film. So when I always defer to him when I'm not sure about something, Ivan and I went and watched it. He kindly bought us a couple of 3D tickets and we went to the IMAX, and it was the best action movie I'd ever seen.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It was amazing. Without any ambiguity, it was by far the best action.
No, I've seen it five times in theater. I mean,
have you? I'm obsessed. Oh, good for you. Yeah. Okay. Because I went back for the second bite the next week. It's quite fine. I'm pleased to find someone that's a fellow enthusiast, because the way it's constructed is... It's a work of genius.
And, I got to have George in this office too for the podcast, which was an amazing treat. And like to see just sort of like, he's talked about it as pure cinema. It's like minimal dialogue yet tells a compelling emotional story at times, and just from the action perspective, it reinvents. I mean, how do you reinvent action now and in his 70s? It's just remarkable to see.
Yeah, and I would argue that the two major parts is the commitment to a style,
yeah,
which is then which has become manifest perfectly.
Yeah,
this is what I want. This is what it will look like, and that vision felt like a director's vision. So 10 out of 10 for that.
Yeah.
And the execution of the action was 10 out of 10 for that.
Yeah.
So you've got two 10 out of 10s.
You're off to a good start.
Yeah, no, it's a big deal. But it's funny how it didn't really get traction with a popular audience.
Yeah, I think it's in that kind of gray zone of whether they could, like, it's so silly to talk at these numbers, but it was like made like almost 400 million. Is that enough to like warrant a sequel and that kind of thing? It's in that weird thing when we get into the silly business side of things. But yeah.
So anyway, there you go. So that was a film that was, is worth talking about.
Who were, I mean, going back when you were a kid, like, were you like a cinephile? Were you like someone that like, when were you most aware of like filmmakers or aware that filmmakers were doing their thing?
If you look at the movies that I download, they're embarrassing. And I would hope that no one has a look at the movies that I download.
Sure, one or two. What do you got?
I've got them all on my phone there. I'm not going to show you. Because I tell you why, because I like watching as many things as I can watch, and I get tickled by things that I'm relatively predictable in the films that I like.
Okay.
Most of the films that I like are animated. So, I'm a big Pixar fan. And I'm a big kids fan. So, you know, a combination of Pixar and kids, you know, Incredibles, I think it's one of the best films ever made. So I can bang on about them for a while.
Yeah.
Just the sheer geniusness. And I'm rather embarrassed to say I was a big fan of Frozen too. partly because I've watched it 1,000 times because all my kids watch it 1,000 times. I've got a 2.5-year-old girl who, you know, that's all she wants to watch is Frozen.
I'm sure.
So I know all the songs.
Yeah. If you want to close out the podcast with your rendition, Let It Go. I won't stop you.
It's not a pretty sound. By the way, I have sung it a lot. So, no, it's funny. It's broad. And then, of course, I like relatively esoteric cinema.
Yeah.
I like foreign cinema. So I'll like lots of stuff that you'd predict that I'd like. And then simultaneously, I mean, the films that I really liked when I was growing up were like, I leaned towards the more popular action stuff, like Where Eagles Dare, that kind of stuff, that the Guns of Navarone, that were kind of accessible and glamorous and broad.
Enter Sergeant Rock. I can see the linkage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like that kind of cinema. And then, you know, like, I love The Prophet. Did you like The Prophet?
Oh, I haven't seen it. I know everyone loved it. Yeah,
I haven't seen it. Yeah. I mean, sensational.
Yeah.
I've seen that 5 times.
Okay. And, I've been busy watching Mad Max every day.
All right.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So, you know, I love Tarantino stuff.
Yeah.
I love a strong director. I still think that filmmaking is a director's medium. And the more director-driven it is, the more I enjoy it.
Yeah.
The more I could smell and feel a director behind a camera, the more... I feel I can relax.
Yeah.
Like Guardians of the Galaxy, out of all those, you know, big
You feel a unique creative vision behind it, which is hard.
Yeah, I just felt a voice. I felt a confident voice. You know, certain people are born to do certain jobs.
Yeah.
And I feel palpable. I feel a palpable sensation when I know a filmmaker was born to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
You know, and there are conspicuous, characters within that. Tarantino is one of those characters. We just know that that's what they were born to do. Hans Zimmer was born to be a composer, and it's so conspicuous.
Yeah.
Well, it's conspicuous to me. And there's all sorts of other filmmakers that I feel that about. And I get quite excited when I feel that.
Yeah. Well, I would honestly extend that back to you. I think anybody that's seen your films, and it doesn't get in the way of the filmmaking, of the fun and the story, but they can see that your stamp on it, and you really brought a great a sense of fun, a sense of style, a sense of coolness to this film. And I congratulate you on it. Man from Uncle's a good piece of work, man. And thanks for stopping by today, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We did it. Any last expletives you want to throw out there?
No, but I tell you what, I do appreciate that last 30 seconds.
Was the other 40 minutes? Was the other 40 minutes as enjoyable, or just you were in it for the last 30?
No, it's a conversation. I like a conversation. And like I said, I thought I was going to have to come into a studio where with everyone had their baseball caps turned backwards, and I was going to have to get down.
Yeah, we're going to do that next. you weren't told? It's good to see you, man. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Womp up the jams, womp it up like a DeJoint. What? This feels really weird without the song. Tough. Can you at least beatbox?
We can't afford it.
Can you beatbox, bitch?
No, you can't. I can't start the tape over.
Bitch, can you beatbox?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't say do like the mating call of a mountain gorilla, Jane Goodall.
No, that's nailed it.
All right. Hey, I'm Marissa Wampler, and my show is called Womp It Up. We're coming at you from the Marina Del Rey Public High School Library, where I'm a student. And every episode, me and my teacher and quasi-legal guardian.
It's legal in Central and parts of South America.
Whatever. We interview the most fascinating teachers, students, and janitors at my school until I overwhelm them with my movie star charm and my incandescent sexuality. Can we play a clip?
Yeah, here it is.
You're not guilty in the eyes of the law.
All right.
Like anyway. O.J. Simpson.
Oh, I don't want to be like O.J. Simpson. That doesn't make me feel good.
Why not? He's a terrific ball player.
Terrific ball player.
Guys.
And a good actor, too.
No, listen.
Not bad.
You're great the wearing only gloves. People, guys, you're the only people who are going to argue in his defense.
I'm not arguing anything. We're just saying that a court of law.
Court of law found him innocent of murder.
So get to earwolf.com for your favorite.
Earwolf.
What I say.
.com. Earwolf. Like Alf, your favorite show.
God, I love that show.
Earwolf.com or your favorite podcast app right now and womp up those jams.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.